Hi, I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 10th, 1979. I have a sponsor. I talked to her today. I need a sponsor today as much as I ever did, despite 29 years. I think that's the right math. My home group is the Jaywalkers, and that's about it, I guess. let's see. Are there any newcomers here that would care to... Okay, just so I know. let's see, what it was like, what happened, what I'm like now. Well, it describes me in the big book, the alcoholic, the guy who's always more or less insanely drunk. And that was me. I was not a controlled drinker. I was a binge drinker, if you think drinking every day is a binge, you know what I mean? You could look at it like that, because there were some times when it was kind of like... it was a vague, I was a blackout drinker. I was a pass-out drinker. I did not drink that long. As you might guess, you know, 29 years ago, I was pretty young. I came into AA when I was 20. I got sober when I was 21. I got drunk once after I came to AA, and I experimented a little bit with wacky tobacco. Thought, you know, that was okay because I didn't have a problem with it, which is not my sobriety days. After everything, I have had nothing mood altering of any kind, illegal, legal, prescribed, bottle, pill, whatever, through the grace of God and the fellowship of AA, not through any merit of my own, not because I've worked a fantastic program, not because I'm special, you know. I am just a garden variety drunk, and I take great hope in that, because garden variety drunks in AA do really well. So that's what I want to be. I just want to be a regular old drunk like you guys, you know. So let's see. I started so I didn't drink that long alcoholically. I would say maybe 5-6 years, something like that. I started drinking when I was about 1 year old. True. I was a social drinker at one. I have a picture of me sitting on a couch when my parents gave me a little beer, you know, a beer bottle and a pretzel, you know. And my parents had the philosophy that if I drank a little bit at home, at the table, in an appropriate fashion all my life, then when I went to college, I wouldn't go berserk. You know what I mean? It was a good theory. It did not pan out in my case. You know what I mean? I really think I was born an alcoholic. I was just waiting for liquor. You know, I was like instant poof, you know. I was like those little sponge critters you buy for kids. You know, they're all squished up. And then you put them in water and woof. And that's pretty much how I was, you know. Just add alcohol and woof. And but pretty much when I, somewhere around 15 or somewhere in there, I started, and pretty much when I started drinking on my own, I just went downhill in a straight line so fast you wouldn't know, you know. I did not put the brakes on. I did not try to put the brakes on. Things would happen, and I would be, like blackouts. I can remember my first blackout, or at least the first blackout when I wasn't in my house, so it was obvious, you know what I mean? When you're at home, it can kind of all blur together anyway, but... And the next morning, I was a little interested in that, and I was asking people, what did I do, what happened, and a little freaked out about it, and then 2 weeks later, it didn't faze me at all. You know, my drinking is the story of accepting whatever came with it, you know, just accept whatever it is and go, you know, and whatever it costs, I was willing to pay. Now, I didn't pay more than I had to, do you know what I mean? But, you know, if I had to do it to drink... You know, I would if I had opportunity. The stuff I didn't do, I didn't have to do, or I didn't have an opportunity to do. You know, it's really my story. Fortunately, I didn't have that much of an opportunity for a lot of stuff. But anyway, so I drank maybe 5-6 years, as I said. And the first year of my, what I would call seriously alcoholic drinking, trying to think of some of the stuff that happened. I totaled cars. I got in a fight. A girl tried to beat me up. I got shot at one night at a party. I got, I was running around with people who were getting in fights all the time, which is what led to, you know, the shooting. all kinds of trauma and drama. You know what I mean? I blacked out. I passed out. I was embarrassed and ashamed, you know. And I didn't, and the interesting thing to me about all that stuff, I never woke up and said, like the day after I totaled the car, I never woke up and said, gee, maybe I should drink less. Didn't cross my mind at all, you know. And when I look back on it, at the end of my drinking, the last year of my drinking, I took off out west with a woman I had met in college, and she had dropped out, and she passed through one day, and we got drunk, and we're singing Girl Scout songs late into the night. And we formed a deep bond, and I decided to head out west with her. Her and her dog, and we headed out west to pick apples. And for a long time, I did not understand what motivated me to go pick apples. I mean, I knew I took off. I thought I would, you know, do something different. I was in pain. I was into geographical cures, you know, like a lot of us. You know, I thought if I could just go over there, go do this, do that, be this person, I'd be okay, you know. So I was always looking around for something besides stopping drinking, you know, to fix me. And so I thought going out west would be cool. And I think, you know, a couple of years ago, I was thinking about what in the world, you know, thought that, you know, picking apples would be a good thing. And I think what it was, I was incredibly confused at this point, you know. And I had read a book, Grapes of Wrath, which was about some real pain and suffering during the Depression and homeless, on the, you know, really, so a lot of suffering. And I had identified with the suffering, because I was in so much pain, totally different circumstances, but I had a lot of that suffering. And I think there was this part of me that, like, if I would do this external thing, like these people in this book who were suffering, I don't know what good would come from it, but I would have a reason for, I don't know. I mean, it was very, but I think that's what drew me to it. Now, they didn't want to give me, you know, nobody wanted to give me a job picking apples. Go figure. Small, drunken woman. Yeah. Not your best apple picker. But I did manage to work in a plant one day packing apples, which is, I can tell you how they get bruised. You stand there with a stick and poke them as they go through this machine so they don't get stuck in the gears. But so anyway, that was, you know, I wound up living out in Oregon. In a house, there were three little cabins right next to each other. We were all drunks. It's this little row of drunks. And I lived in a house. There were six of us, one bedroom, no heat. It's cold in Oregon. We had a wood stove, but not, I have a wood stove now, but it's a good wood stove. You know what I mean? It's the kind that'll last all night, you know. This stove was sort of a more decorative than functional, you know. And by the time I got to AA, I did not bathe regularly. When I took off out west, I was wearing this dress I had found in the garbage that was like a size 20, and I probably was like a size 8 back then, you know what I mean? Because I didn't eat a lot. I drank my dinner. I was small with a beer belly, you know what I mean? And I had this, it didn't have any sleeves, and it was tan. I mean, it was ugly. I don't know why I wore it, but I did every day. And including to bed, you know. I would, if I took a shower, I'd take it off, shower, and put it back on. I mean, I was just a treat. I don't know what. I think about it now, and I wore these white socks and hiking boots, you know what I mean? I was just like, and I didn't shave. I was just, you know, in an alternate reality. That's all. I don't know what I was trying to do. I really don't, but that's, you know, going around, traveling around, washing my hair in the park, or, you know, cleaning up in bathrooms, you know, dirty gas station bathrooms, kind of, you know, wash your face, and, you know, sleeping wherever, you know. We slept in the rain. We slept in an abandoned lot in a city, which I tell you, I didn't want to do it then. I don't want to do it now. That is not a good place to sleep. It's not like camping out in the mountains or something, you know what I mean? For a while, we hooked up for a couple of weeks with these homeless bums, you know, except two of them had a vehicle. One of them was, you know, a real live hobo, just sort of hitchhiking around, you know, no home. Then we wound up in Oregon at this house. And there was a guy there who wanted to be my boyfriend. who I didn't want to be girlfriends with, and so I wasn't for a couple weeks. But then one night I was lonely and drunk, and there were a lot of strangers in the house, and so I hooked up with him. And also, and I always felt deeply ashamed about this, it was also convenient to be hooked up with a guy whose house it was, place to stay, and then I felt horrible about that, like one step away from prostitution. Do you know what I mean? That's how I felt. And I mean, there was positive stuff too, you know. Very interestingly, I mean, I was deeply ashamed of him. I never told anybody about him after I left because he was had killed people and had knifed somebody to death and had been over in Vietnam and done lots. You know, he a rough guy, been in a motorcycle gang in California. And when I knew him, he was even though drunk like me, he was actually getting a little better. He had quit the gang, you know. And when I left, he was going to go to AA to try to get out of a drunk driving ticket, and I hope he did, and I hope it stuck. I've never been able to find him, you know. And so I sincerely hope, you know. But anyway, so that's where I was. I was my mental state. One night, this is a true story. One night, I were laying on the, you know, we took turns with the bedroom. High-class house situation, right? So we're in there, and I was not drunk yet. I mean, I might have had a few little to drink. I don't remember. And that might have been the problem, that I wasn't drunk. And we're laying on the mattress on the floor, and it's a little cabin out in the woods, you know, in Oregon, in the mountains. And I knew, and the corner of the room is the corner of the house, and I knew, and I still believe it today, I knew there was a monster, a beast right outside this cabin. And it was telling me to pick up the knife under the mattress and kill my boyfriend. And it totally freaked me out. I was, you know, that kind of vibrating scare, terror. And I just didn't. You know, and it still feels really real even now. But that's kind of my mental, that's where I was mentally. We went into a, it was this old, you know, cabin. Somebody had left a pile of magazines, and there was, you heard what I was wearing, right? Same thing over and over, and I didn't shave and, you know, bathe much. And I found, this is why this is so funny, I found this magazine, I think it was a Cosmopolitan, but one of those beauty magazines, and there was this whole routine in this magazine about cleaning your face. You had to massage it for like half an hour with cold cream and wipe it off, and it was very elaborate. And for some reason, I decided to do this. I wasn't going to shower, but I was going to do this half-hour routine or like that. It was not all together, you know what I mean? Not all there. But anyway, so we went to the grocery store to get some cold cream and cotton balls, which is another really like crazy thing because we didn't have any money. And the pharmacist was watching us because we were the kind of people you had to watch because, you know, might steal something. And my boyfriend handed me a bag of cotton balls that were sterile, you know, for medical reasons. And I said, oh, we don't need sterile ones because, you know, it can be just the cheaper kind. And the pharmacist said, because he's watching us and listening, and he said, you know, most people don't know that. And that was the nicest thing that happened to me when I was out there. I felt like, you know, I was so low that little kind comment flattering me made me feel worthy, worthwhile. Do you know what I mean? And, which today, I mean, it's pathetic. I was pathetic drunk. You know what I mean? I was not a glamorous, obviously. I passed out in public bathrooms, which that's a sign right there. Regular people do not pass. They do not pass out in regular in public bathrooms, especially more than once. It just doesn't happen. Nor do they choose to sleep on the floor at rock concerts, which I did more than once, you know. And I always called it sleeping, you know. That's the delusion. I slept in funny places, fully clothed. A lot of times it was like, you know, just a couple feet from my bed. You know what I mean? I just couldn't quite make it onto my bed, you know. And so that was my drinking. And I had thought at one point in my drinking that people would just leave me alone and let me drink to my heart's content, I'd be okay. But when I was out west, I drank to my heart's content, as much money as I could get. I was broke a lot, you know, so it was really hard to scrounge up money, and I would drink anything. And So you get the picture of my drinking. That's my drinking. The way I felt was lonely. I felt like an alien from outer space. I felt like I didn't fit anywhere. I believed that part of the time I was drunk, I was in college. I believed, and so I wrote a paper about this. I believed that there was no such thing as happiness, and everybody running around pretending to be happy was pretending to be happy, that it wasn't real. And I was just too desperately unhappy to even pretend, you know, and why bother? And except to get people to like you. You know, if you pretend to be happy, they'll like you. I was just desperately lonely. Desperately lonely. I would go into bars and get into arguments with people. That was my connecting, you know, about, you know, philosophical arguments and debates about anything, you know. I wasn't connected. I had promised to quit for my parents. I was a rotten older sister. I had parties at my house when I was in high school and exposed my sister to people, a little sister who she shouldn't have been, you know what I mean? Which, you know, someone did that to my daughter. fortunately, nothing happened bad, but still, just random luck, you know, or whatever. So that's kind of drunk I was. I had been in the hospital drunk from falling down, dislocating my elbow, and apparently made a scene there. And the next day, people were not very nice to me because I had, like, refused to sign to do treatment. You know, just on and on and on and on. The thing that finally, you know, and I had a lot of trauma and drama and adventure, and obviously, in my drinking days. And it's funny, the thing that finally sent me to AA was just a typical night. I went out. I drank more than I meant to. I was with some people, drank at dinner. Then we went to a liquor store. I bought a gallon of wine. And I can remember figuring out how much it cost, you know, how many cents per ounce, that kind of thing. And it was cheaper to buy the big one, of course, per ounce. I wasn't going to drink it all. Of course I did, and it wasn't enough. And I'd go back to the bar, you know. And I drank at a really cheap beer bar where you could get, you know, a quarter for a glass. And then Fridays, you could drink all you wanted for a dollar and get just loaded, you know. Or $1.50, I don't know, cheap, you know. So anyway, I woke up, I was sick again, you know. I'd had a blackout again. I probably had passed, I don't remember. I missed something else I was supposed to do that day again. You know, I was just constantly goofing up, you know. I just couldn't keep it together, you know, and I felt horrible again, you know, ashamed again, and I had seen a counselor off and on because I was in college at this point. My parents kept sending me back, thank goodness, you know. They enabled me, thank God. Always makes me crazy when people talk about somebody enabling them, like it's the enabler's fault that I drink. You know, it's my drinking, I'm the drunk, regardless of what they do, enabling or not, I'm going to drink, you know. And if their kindness helped, you know, kept me a little better off, really, my parents. So anyway, she had said to me some months earlier something about somebody being in AA at college where I was. And I had, you know, she asked me if I wanted any help, and I said, no, you know, not AA. But I woke up that morning, and I just called her, and I said, who's that guy in AA? She gave me his name. He was another student, and I went over to see him. He actually had an office because he was doing something for the school, organizing concerts or something. So I went over and saw him, and I was so ashamed, and I walked up, and I whispered so nobody could overhear us, you know, if they were walking in the hall. I said, I'm here to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he talked to me a little bit, and then we walked back to his dorm room where he had all his AA literature. And I can remember walking down the sidewalk. This is the most vivid thing about this. This was a Friday. It was a bright, sunny day out. Walking down the sidewalk, and he offered me some M&Ms, some candy, chocolate, and he said, and I said, oh, no, I don't eat candy. I mean, I didn't eat much. I drank my dinner, you know? And he said, well, a lot of us find that chocolate can be really helpful when you have a craving. And that was the first time there was an us. You know? He said, we and us. And before that, you know, I was the kind of person, I was really baffled. It talks about that in the big book, we're a baffled lot. I really had no idea what was going on, you know. And I was the kind of, well, you know, I'm a, you know, to me, what alcoholism is, you know, the physical part is that when I take one drink, I can't stop. You know, and every time, some people apparently, sometimes they only got, they didn't always get drunk when they drank. When I drank, I always got drunk. Every time I took a drink, a whole lot more followed, as much as I could get. That's my story. And I kept drinking. I kept taking that first drink. And in fact, that first drink for me felt like the second one. I did not really see that much of a distinction when I was new between the first drink and the second drink because I had to have that first drink. You know, I had to drink. I felt like if I didn't have that drink, I was going to explode. I quit drinking once for 2 weeks, several weeks, you know, years before I came into AA. But I really couldn't go a day without drinking. And he asked me that. He said, can you stay sober till Sunday? And I'll take you to a meeting Sunday night. And I was like, oh, I don't know. You know what I mean? And he handed me his big book. And he said, why don't you read some of the stories in the back? And I'll come and get you Sunday, and we'll go to a meeting Sunday night. And try not to drink. And he told me how not to drink. He said, we don't quit forever, we just don't drink today. And he said, and the way we do that is we don't take the first one, and we just put the first one off. He said, just put it off till tomorrow. He said, if you can't wait till tomorrow, put it off till tonight. If you can't wait till tonight, put it off for an hour. Just keep putting it off. And that's how I got sober. I just kept putting it off. And he gave me his big book, and like a good alcoholic, I didn't follow directions. Instead, I started at the beginning and started reading it. And that's how I got sober. I was in somebody else's dorm room, because my dorm room looked like a drunk lived there, and it was very nasty. And my dorm room, let me tell you about my room. One day when I was running out to throw up in the morning, I knocked all these bottles on the floor, and they had all broken. And I had not cleaned them up. I just wore shoes. That's the kind of solutions I had. I would wear shoes and get to my bed and take the shoes off, you know. That's the kind, that's my solution, you know. Heard somebody say once, the only thing worse than my problems are my solutions to my problems. Which is true, you know. But anyway. So I read the big book, and I didn't drink, and I didn't sleep. Because I had to drink to sleep or pass out. You know, I passed out every night. And so I read the big book, and I'm reading along in here, and I can never remember exactly where it is, but there's this, and I started, I was a baffled person, and I was always asking people in bars or, you know, parties, you know, what do you think? I was really open to information, I think I was. You know, I was confused and lost and looking for something. So I would ask people, who, of course, couldn't tell me anything. And when I started, what was wrong with me? I knew something was wrong with me. I mean, I felt like I was an alien from outer space. I knew something was wrong with me. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I kind of figured you'd drink, too, if you had my problems, you know what I mean? And I was reading along in this book, and I started to think, like, these people understand me. This is how I am. And I was starting to get some hope, like, this might work for me. You know what I mean? This might... I was not interested in just not drinking. I have never been interested in that. Well, and I was really lucky. What I got that first night from reading the book was, this is about a whole new life. And I was interested in a whole new life. You know? I was so desperate and in so much pain from my drinking, and everything I tried failed. You know? I mean, I tried a lot of stuff like we all do, you know? And none of it worked. I just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I had actually even already noticed the progressive nature of alcoholism. I used to sit and think, drunk, you know, I drank alone a lot. I just give you an idea of my delusion. Somebody asked me that question, you know, do you drink alone? I said no, because I didn't want to drink alone. So it didn't count. True. That's how my mind worked. It didn't count because I didn't want... If there had been people there, I would have preferred it, you know. But anyway, so I would be drinking alone, thinking about 4 months ago, and I would be reminiscing about how great it was 4 months ago. And then 4 months later, I'd be reminiscing about how great it was 4 months ago. And about the third time I did this, I thought, I've done this before. I am looking back to a day that day seemed so horrible that I was looking back before that. And someday I'm going to look, in 4 months from now, I don't know why it was 4 months, but it was. I'm going to look back to today, and today's going to look good. And today was bad. You know, I knew it was progressive. You know, I had noticed that. So, anyway, I'm reading this book, and I'm starting to get some hope that they seem to understand me, you know, because I didn't understand me. And then I got to the section where it says something like, if you think you have a trouble with alcohol, if you're not sure, try not drinking for a year. And I read that, and I was just like, no way. I mean, if I have to quit for a year, I'm going to die, because I can't do it. I cannot do it. And if this depends on me doing it, then I'm sunk. I mean, it was horrible. I just was like this horrible feeling. Then a couple sentences later, it says, most to whom this book appealed will not be able to stay sober and dry or whatever, anything like a year. Most will be drunk within a week. And that was me. And that's when I'm like, okay. And that happened that first weekend sometime. And so he came and he got me, took me to a meeting on Sunday night, and this was in Wisconsin, and we went to this meeting. It was all men, except for me. They were all these old men, 40, 50, and 60, 70 or something. And this guy who took me was young, so we were both, you know, in our 20s early. And shortly sometime after that, he left, so I was the only young person there, only female, only young person, and it didn't matter. Because I was desperate. I was desperate. You know, when you're ready, none of that stuff matters. I'm drunk, you know. So, and that very first meeting he took me to, there was some people there talking, and he introduced me, you know, how we do, introduce people around. And I remember this one guy, he'd been to a convention, some AA convention or retreat or something, and he was going on and on and on about all the love in the air, you know, this kind of stuff. And I had been like a tough chick. I didn't tell you about that, but one of the things I tried in my drinking days was a tough chick. I was also a hippie child, you know, all these different things, bad lady in training, you know, and that's what I really was. But anyway, I remember listening to him, and I'm tough. I was listening to him, I went, oh, wimp. Right, talking about this love stuff, you know. I didn't say that because I was too scared. But that's what I thought. And then another part of me deeper inside was attracted to that. Do you know what I mean? I had no idea what he was talking about. But I was attracted to that, you know. And I didn't know for several years any inkling of what love is. I mean, really, no idea at all. And that's one of the things I've gotten from the program is... love, to me, is an expression of my higher power. And love happens when my selfishness and self-centeredness is squashed temporarily, and I can care more about you than about me. You know, and I have your best interest at heart, with no thought of reward or anything. You know, I just... and I learned about love. I don't know how I got off onto that, but I'll tell you how I learned about love besides coming to meetings. I learned about love by the actions of AA members towards me and what I started doing towards newcomers. That's how I learned about love. And there's a saying some people say about you can't, something like you can't learn to love others till you love yourself, but that is not my experience. My experience is I learned how to love you. And one day I found I was loving myself. You know, I was, I don't even remember who it was, but it was in the 80s. It was in Michigan. I was talking to some new woman. I was probably maybe sponsoring her. I don't know. I was talking to her, and she was full of self-loathing, guilt, you know, self-hatred, feeling lower than a worm. You know how we are, right? She's feeling like that. She's talking like that. She's not worthy of anything, you know. And I'm sitting there, and I think she's beautiful. I think she has a beautiful spirit. I think all this stuff she feels bad about is nothing but mud on the truck. If good rain will wash it off, you know, God will send some sun and clean it up. And I think she's fantastic. I don't see any of the stuff she sees, and I believe it 100%. And then it suddenly struck me. I'm just like her. And all those feelings that I had, self-loathing and all that, was gone too. Do you know what I mean? That's how it happened for me. And love to me is something that God pours through me to you. And I love it when, especially when I'm sponsoring somebody, it seems to happen the most. Talking to them, and I'm just so intent on them that God will just work through me. And it's kind of like being in a desert where there are irrigation ditches, you know, or out in Colorado or somewhere where they shut the rivers off, you know what I mean? And God opens up the gate and lets the water through, going somewhere else, going to this person I'm trying to help. But some of it feeds me on the way through. You know, I can't help but water my banks too. Do you know what I mean? So, I don't know how I got off on that. But anyway, let's talk about how this guy, the very first meeting, this loving thing Mike did. We're sitting at this, and I think this is the kind of love people do for each other in AA that I have experienced. We sat on this huge table. When the basket went around at the end, he hadn't thought to tell me about that. You know, you don't have to put anything in, and there's no dues or fees, you know. And the basket came around, and I didn't have any money. I was broke, you know. The basket came around, and he put in $2. And, I mean, this is 1979. People did not, you know, sometimes today people put in $2. But it's remarkable. We have inflation everywhere, but in the AA basket. But anyway, he put in $2, and I knew he was paying my way because I didn't have any money. It was just a simple consideration, you know what I mean, until he could explain, you know. And, you know, that's just the kind of stuff we do. And I used to be full of really super self-centered fear, you know. And, for me, I never understood when I first came in, people talk about ego. I don't know what the heck they were talking about. You know what I mean? Because I felt so low, lower than a worm. I mean, just so low, so nothing. And I just didn't understand this whole ego thing because I thought that meant you were, like, doing really well and thinking really well of yourself and really proud and, do you know what I mean? And that was not what I was experiencing. But what the ego can be is just consumed with self. It does not have to be consumed with self in the sense of I'm great. It can be consumed with self like I'm the worst thing ever. You know what I'm saying? And that was what my experience was, is I just felt so horrible. I would go to meetings, and I was afraid to look at people, look them in the eye, because they wouldn't like me, you know? I was afraid to say hi to people first, because they might not say hi back, because I was just so horrible, you know what I mean? And so I was running around with that kind of thing, and I remember the first time I was with my sponsor, and there was this new woman, Connie, and she was crying because she had gotten drunk or something the night before, and we're in the bathroom. And I had a meeting, you know, and she's too upset to leave, you know, one of those deals. And I was with my sponsor, and I felt such compassion for her and her pain. I reached out and put my arm around her. I forgot about my own fear for a minute. You know what I mean? And that's where a lot of my growth has come from, where I just forget about me. You know, and but anyway, God, I'll have to do some stuff on the steps here. When I came in, I did not have a relationship with God at all. I didn't believe in God. I didn't disbelieve. It was just like something else. Kind of like football. I don't know anything about football. I don't have any opinions on football. If I'm drunk and I'm lonely, I might get in a fight in a bar with you about football, something I know nothing about, just to have something to connect about, you know what I'm saying? That's kind of what God was to me, you know, something to argue about in bars and because it's hot, you know. So when I came in, you know, and I admitted that I was, I mean, it was, to me, a drunk when I was new, and today is somebody who's powerless over alcohol. And I could totally relate to that. I was powerless over alcohol. Once I took a drink, I lit the fire and I had to drink as much as I could. And I kept taking the drink. So, I mean, it was really clear to me I was powerless. I got that right away. As soon as I read it and read some, you know, I identify with that. Okay, I'm powerless over alcohol. Which puts you in big trouble. Because what are you going to do? You know what I mean? I also, luckily, could see that my life was unmanageable and that I had made a mess of it. You know, I got that pretty good. And I still see that, you know. I go along in sobriety, and things start to get good, and next thing you know, I'm running the show again. You know what I mean? I slipped. God will give me these. God will give me a great job. Next thing you know, I'm making sure I'm keeping it, which creates all kinds of havoc, let me tell you. Or, you know, God will give me a lot of stuff, and then I start trying to improve on it or hold on to it or get something more. Then I get, you know, start trying to run the show, and I get make a big mess in my life. So it's my life is still unmanageable. So I got that much pretty much when I was, because I was beat when I got here, which was lucky. You know, the gift of, I had the gift of desperation. I was just beat. Then I came across the second step, you know, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I knew I needed sanity, so I didn't have any trouble with that part. In fact, I was kind of glad to see it. The only thing I had trouble was restore. Like, I don't know if I ever had any. Do you know what I mean? To be restored to. But I kind of glossed over that. And to me, the second step was kind of like, there better be something else. There better be something else, because I am in a whole lot of trouble. You know, I have given it my best for as long as I could stand it. Or, you know, and there better be something else. And then I came to the third step, and I think I was reading the big book. Like I said, I was really lucky. I started reading the big book and started trying to do it right away. And I think I probably said the third step prayer, because why wouldn't I? I don't remember saying it. I remember some of my later gyrations over the third step, you know. But it was kind of like, in the very second meeting I went to, a guy gave me a book, a non-AA approved book, so I won't mention it, but which was, had, you know, daily readings, which I read, which I didn't believe. And somebody told me to get on my knees and pray, which I did. And I had the kind of prayers, you know, how you shut all the drapes, you look around, you shut your door, make sure nobody's looking, and I get down on my knees and pray to the ceiling. If you're there, I don't really believe in you, but please help, kind of prayer, you know, which was a very honest prayer, and I think God loves those prayers. God loves those honest prayers. My God, my higher power. And for a long time, I couldn't use the word God because I had all these old ideas attached to that word. So whenever I said the word God, all these old incorrect ideas came roaring in. And it really doesn't matter where I got those old ideas. I probably invented some of them because I was pretty inventive. So using the phrase higher power worked for me a lot. I mean, I was definitely some kind of a God thing. God, you know. But I used that word, because higher power, because it made me think of the God you guys talked about. And the God you guys talked about was different than these old ideas I had. It was powerful, loving, cared about me, would do something to help me. Very simple. You know, I didn't have to go anywhere or profess anything or dress a certain way or anything to have access to this higher power. And I didn't have to be good to have, you know. This was a higher power, you know. It came to me some years later that, but I think this is the kind of God we talk about here. God, my God loved me at my worst. You know what I mean? When I was half naked, passed out in a public bathroom. You know what I mean? With vomit on me. You know what I mean? At my worst and whatever else. You know what I mean? At my worst, God loved me. Not because I was going to clean up good and do great things. Just because he loves me. Now, God wants to clean me up and give me on this way of life because it makes me happy. And it makes me useful to help his other suffering kids who are passed out in public bathrooms somewhere. Do you know what I mean? But it's not that I get good to earn his approval or anything. You know, because I can't even get good on my own. You know, that's to me what step 6 and 7 says. Is that, you know, I don't even have, even, you know, I don't have power to stop drinking. I don't have power to stop being selfish and resentful. It tells me that in the 4th step. I can't wish away my resentments. You know? I can't, when I see my character defects, and you know, in the 4th step, and I get ready to get rid of them in the 6th step, I can't make them go away. I have to ask God for help there, too. You know, I just don't have any power. Lack of power is my dilemma in a huge way, you know what I mean, even today, especially today. I think I'm sicker now than when I came in, except I'm sober and in God's hands right now. more or less, you know. I like to jump out of his hand sometimes a little bit, you know. I've never totally turned my back on God, but you know. Actually, what I like to do with God is, it's a story, you know. God is a story about a father carrying a boy, or, you know, a mother carrying a daughter, whatever. You know, an adult carrying a child, and the child has a backpack full of rocks. And God's like, or the parent's like, drop the rocks. You know, you don't need to carry them. I'll carry them for you. And the kid's like, oh, no, I want to help you. Of course, God carrying the whole package. He doesn't help at all. You know, that's kind of like I am. I'll be like, you know what? Here, let me carry these for a while. Let me lighten your load. Right. But anyway. So I started praying. I surrendered as best I could. And actually, my sobriety date, you know, that I gave September 10th, what really happened then is when it finally clicked. That's when the third step, I think, really clicked. Because nobody was telling me. I smoked pot just a couple of times. Because I had sat down and figured out I could do that without drinking. And I did. You know, it was okay, blah, blah, blah. And it just came to me. Nobody was telling me not to do drugs. And, you know, it just came to me that sobriety is total. And that's when the third step, to me, just kicked in. It's my sobriety date, and the third step really kicked in, is that sobriety means nothing for a drunk, because I'm a drunk, not because I'm an addict or anything, because I'm a drunk. You know, I can't afford to take that stuff, you know? So anyway, I started trying to do a four-step right away, a couple weeks sober. My very first four-step, I wrote like a page, and I did the three-column one, because I hadn't quite read further that there's more to it. But it was fantastic, because it was sincere, it was honest, and I was terrified. I felt like I was this cave, and there was a monster in there. You know, that monster that was outside the cabin telling me to kill you. There was a monster in there, and the last thing I wanted to do was look at myself, because I was afraid. But I did. You know, tried to do the four step. I didn't have a sponsor, you understand. I'm a couple weeks sober and doing this stuff, reading the book. I understand the old days when people would get a hold of the big book and get sober. Because I actually had, you know, I was going to meetings, so I had that community, but I didn't have a sponsor because it was all men, and I had somehow got that you're supposed to get a woman. There weren't any, so there I was, you know, without a sponsor. But anyway, I felt like I was this huge, horrible cave, and there was this monster in there, and if I went in there, I might get eaten alive and killed, you know, suffered, you know. Felt like a horror film, you know what I mean? Don't go! Don't go! You know. And I went in with this little flashlight and lived to tell the tale. That was the main thing I got from the first thing. I was willing to try, and then I lived through it. So it was great, and there was even a little bit of honesty in it, you know. But then I got bogged down in the fifth step because I didn't have a sponsor. So I kept sort of doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, until finally, and I stayed sober because I was sincerely trying to find someone to do a fifth step with. I went to a counselor and quickly figured out that she was not on track with what I was trying to accomplish. Talks about that in here. Make sure they understand what you're trying to do. I set up an appointment. I lived in a different town where there were some women. I set up an appointment with a woman, and she stood me up. True story. And which was perfect. I mean, what's the worst thing that can happen with a fifth step? One of them is being stood up. I mean, there's other worse things. Sometimes, you know, I think my God lets what I'm afraid of happen because then I can live through it. And maybe she wasn't the right person. You know, but I was driving down the road crying and beating the steering wheel, you know, I'm trying. And I was so desperate, I just asked a friend of mine in the program, a guy, and I did it with him, and it was perfect. You know, my first fifth step. And sometime after that, I hooked up with my first sponsor, Carol, and I asked her to be my sponsor for a profound reason. She gave me her phone number. You know, I mean, it's... And she was perfect. You know, I was already reading the big book and trying to do the big book, and her strength was, and I was very dark. You know, I had a really dark view of the world, and, you know, and she was very optimistic, and she had this great, sunny faith in God. Do you know what I mean? And she just thought things were going to work out, and, you know, it was really good for me to be with her. She also invited me into her life, which I think is one of the greatest things sponsors can do. And I saw stuff happen in her life, and I saw her living her life, and I learned a lot just from watching her and imitating, you know. And she threw me into the fellowship, which I had not really, I mean, I was going to meetings and I'm trying to do this stuff, but I just had not been part of the community. I love A Vision for You, where it talks about, you know, the dark grimness of alcoholism and then the life we have here, where we're in each other's homes, we're helping each other out, we're going and visiting sick people, we're bringing the message to the drunk. You know, we're talking about God. We're, you know, marching arm in arm on the road to happy destiny. And I think that's a huge part of the program. I heard a talk or a tape or something recently, and the guy said, if all you're doing is going to meetings, you're really not doing AA. You know, and it's more than just working with a sponsor. It's this community. And when I was, when Carol was my sponsor in Michigan, and I was in her house all the time, I was carrying the message to other alcoholics. I got involved in all kinds of service. I had many wonderful things happen. I'll tell you this really cool miracle story. I always want to talk about miracles, and then I never do, except for the miracle of me being sober, which is huge. I had this woman crashing in my house, my floor, because I didn't have any furniture. And I didn't have any furniture because at this time in my life, I was very scared about not being able to support myself. So I was, I kept reading the Sermon on the Mount over and over, including the part about don't worry about what you're ready to eat or what you're going to wear. Your father knows you need these things. And I got into this thing of every month, I saved $500 prudent reserve. I paid my bills, and then I gave the rest of my money away every month, which was really cool. I walked around listening for where God might want me to give this money away, which I'm just blown away today when I think, I don't do that today. Of course, I haven't been led to do it, I hope, I don't think. So, I have kids now. That's where my all my money's going there. But, so I didn't have any furniture. And I was not, like, rich. Obviously, I didn't have any furniture. I mean, I had a bed, you know? And I didn't have, I had this living room. I think I had an old chair. So she was sleeping on my floor, newcomer in the program, sober. She's sleeping on my floor, and we heard somebody say, they need some women in the jail to go to a meeting. So being totally ignorant about, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever done, you know, prison or jail work, but you have to get cleared, and sometimes it takes months. You have to get cleared and get a training, and they do a background check, and they want to know everything about you, you know, before you can even go in, usually. So we didn't know that. We just showed up at the jail at the right time. Nobody from AA was there. They didn't show up. And this is the kind of stuff that used to just happen to me all the time. It still does today sometimes. They just let us in. Say, hey, you're here. Come on in. Okay, so we went in. We had a meeting. Miracle number one, yeah. They just let us in. Then on the way out, miracle number two, somebody says, hey, we need a meeting in this women's jail over here. You guys want to start one next week? Sure. Just, you know. When stuff is right with God, you know, things just go like that. I'm going to run out of time here. Let me just tell you where I am today. I was incredibly lonely, awkward, scared, useless, fearful. I have changed so much, you wouldn't even recognize me. You know what I mean? Since I came into the program, I've got a college degree, a graduate degree. I've gotten a career, which was a whole God thing, and something I was never trained in, computer programming, who would figure? I didn't choose it. It just sort of happened, you know, one day at a time, doing God's will. Next thing you know, I'm doing that. 4 or 5 years ago, I got strong guidance from my higher power to adopt some children. I had a lot of, maybe it was 6 years ago, because it took me a while to finally say yes. I couldn't believe it. I'm 50. Like, are you crazy? I must be imagining this. I checked it out with people in the program everywhere I turned. Yes, 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 yes. I went through the process. My husband and I hooked up with one of the few agencies in the country that'll give you two children that are unrelated. Most of them won't do that, same age. We now have a boy and a girl who are three now. What an adventure. You know, what an adventure. Who would ever thought that people would entrust children to my husband's care? You know? We have, when I came into the program, I didn't own a car. I didn't own anything, hardly. Records. I had some record albums, you know. Some cigarettes. Some clothes found in the trash. You know, you get the picture, right? I didn't own anything. And today, my husband and I have a 108-acre farm. All from God. You know? All from God. You know, and I've had some remarkable experiences. I'll try to tell you one real quick. When we moved into this farm, some guy who didn't even own any land sued us, and all our neighbors turned out we had moved into a lawsuit-prone guy who had been suing our neighbors for 20 years. And when we moved in, we got to join the party, and just one of these people, you know what I mean? Totally idiotic. However, it took several years and $40,000. I built a road trying to avoid a lawsuit because we looked, you know, just, and I won't go into the details. I was insane. Randy might remember this. I used to go to meetings and I was like, how could this be happening to me? It's so bad. You know, I was a little off my game back then. I want to say that. I want to say that. There have been many times. I have not had, like, this sobriety that was just like, you know, I have had times when I stayed sober. God kept me sober because I let him, you know. But I have been pretty lunatic at times and had some really hard times. But anyway, including this guy. And the thing about it was, is, and I loved a line, you know, we cannot wish away resentments, right? Because we know that after a while, I'm not supposed to have resentments. Resentments are going to kill me. They block me off from God. And I was just full of resentments, you know, and I kept trying to let go, you know, and inventory, and, you know, write and fist up and all that, and pray, you know, the whole thing. And then he would do something else. And I'd be, ah! He kept doing stuff, you know, day after day for several years. It was horrible. I was insane. I was insane. I certainly was not showing, you know, it says in here, we have stopped fighting anything or anyone. Well, I was not there. I was, you know, I had my dukes up, man. I was ready to fight. So we went through this long, horrible thing, and we won, finally. I don't know what kind of a victory that is, though. That was insane for several years and cost $40,000. I mean, that's like money we didn't have, you know. We kept paying him. Anyway. But eventually, he was so ridiculous, he ended up having to pay us our lawyer's fees, which is what the 40 grand was. And so I won't go into the whole thing of trying to collect it, but it got to the point where, you know, we were trying to collect it, and one day it came to me, and I was actually on a better spiritual journey at this point. I had connected up with this new wonderful home group and a new sponsor, and it was really redone, you know, a lot of stuff, and another inventory, and one day it came to me, I had to forgive this guy. So I went through this thing of, well, you know, at first I was resistant, but about a day later, I mean, I was desperate. Nothing like desperation to get you to do the right thing, you know? So I said, okay, I'll forgive him. Okay, God. Then I was like, well, what does that mean? As soon as I said, okay, God, I felt better. I mean, I felt a lot better. Being peace was incredible. I can't believe it happened. I mean, it was a miracle. Because if you knew how crazed and you can imagine, right? The situation. And I was like, well, does that mean I can forgive him in my heart, but the lawyer can still keep going after the money? And I talked to a bunch of people, and they're like, yeah, you can do that. So I'm doing that. But I prayed. You know, I talked to my sponsor. She said, well, if you don't know, tell God this is what you're going to do. And if he wants to stop you, he can. So I did that. And I'm going along. I'm feeling great for months. And all of a sudden, something happened. And I knew it was God stopping me. And I had to not even go after the money. So then I talked to a bunch of people, a lot of the same ones. It was kind of funny. Second time around, they're like, oh, yeah. You can't go after that. So I had to drop it. And so I went to call the guy up. And so that, it's important I had that question, because the question was, when you forgive somebody, do you forgive them the consequences? of what they did, you know. And so I called the guy up on the phone to forgive him and tell him I was going to let go because we're still trying to pursue the money. And I got on the phone with him, and he started attacking me and blaming me for the whole thing. And I tell you what, if I had not felt God right behind me, pushing, I would have just said a few choice words and said, see you in court. Because I was in a situation where it wasn't costing me any money to pursue him, but it was costing him. So I tell you, the revengeful thing to do would have been to make him pay, even if I didn't win, you know. But I just didn't do that because I really felt God pushing me. And after a little while, it got to the point, several phone conversations, where he started to like me because I dropped, you know, and it turned out he was dying. And when he died, you know, a couple months later, I heard about it. My husband mentioned it to me, and I cried. That's a miracle. That is a miracle that that happened to me. And not only that, but now I know something that probably other people can have just learned about forgiveness. Somebody might have just told them and they'd believe it. I've learned for me, I need forgiveness. I mess up all the time. I know what forgiveness is now. It means I don't have to pay the debt. I don't have to pay what I owe, you know? And so it was an incredible, wonderful experience looking at it now, you know? But now, and I'm the kind of person, I had to go to the school of hard knocks, you know, what can I say? Other people, you tell them that and they're like, oh, cool. But, so anyway, I love AA. I'm so glad I'm here. When I came here, it's the last place I wanted to be, like all of us. Who wants to do any of this stuff, you know? Even today, who wants to? Sometimes I have to make myself call my sponsor, I really. But when I am really on the AA beam, I'll say one other thing. My sponsor said this recently, and her sponsor told her, I love it. He told her, the work is not the steps. The work is carrying the message. The steps just get us ready to do the work, which I love. You know, it's not about, I have gotten lost in sobriety of starting to think it's about getting my life straightened out and getting to be everything I never had. You know, get the guy, get the job, get the house, get balanced. You know, get psychologically fit, get friends, get whatever, healthy, you know. And then, of course, I start trying to run the show what that means, you know. And that is not what it's about. It is not about getting that. In seventh step, when I ask God to relieve me of these defects of character, it's so that I can be useful. Not so I can get out of debt, win Miss America, have a great job, have a good resume, you know. It's so I can be useful. And same thing in the men's. We're fitting ourselves to be of maximum service. You know, over and over, this is about being useful to God and others. You know, we have a unique gift to reach out to other alcoholics that God gave us that other people can't do. As much as they would like to, there are many people who would like to help us. You know, and it wasn't until another drunk talked to me about us that I could get out of hell. You know, so there, and when I'm doing it, it's bliss. It's really bliss. So thanks a lot.